and welcome to the American Compass podcast. I'm Orrin Cass, Executive Director at American Compass, and this is Policy in Brief, which, as you may guess from the title, is a brief discussion of a policy. We have a very special holiday edition focused on the family, and here to talk family policy is first our Policy Director, Chris Griswold. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am doing fine, especially because we are joined as well for this very special holiday edition by our resident Santa Claus and research director, Wells King. Wells, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Pumped that you're here, man.
The topic is family policy, and the proposal, one of the American Compass signature ideas that we have out there, is the Family Income Supplemental Credit, or FISC. Usually we let Chris tell us a little bit about that, but we're going to change it up. Wells, tell us a little bit about the FISC.
The FISC is a monthly cash benefit for American working families. It's calculated based on your prior year income. It includes a marriage bonus for married parents and couples. And it's aimed at ultimately addressing what we see as a core challenge that American families face, which is that it's increasingly hard to raise and support a family with today's labor market.
And let's put just dimensions on the size of this. If you're a family working middle class income, two or three kids, what are you receiving?
Yeah. So suppose, for instance, you're a couple with three kids, and you know an annual income of $40,000. You can expect to receive $15,120. That's just depending on the age and range of kids. So it's $400 a month from birth to 6 years old per child, and then $250 a month thereafter until they turn 18.
And I think one interesting piece that we have in the proposal that's also worth emphasizing, especially as folks think in a post-Roe world about what family policy can look like, is that this is a benefit that would actually start during pregnancy. And so I think it's starting the fifth month of pregnancy, and an expectant mother would begin receiving the benefit, which first of all can help support someone who wants to step away from the workforce at that point. And second of all, also gives a family a chance to start saving up potentially for what are a lot of very significant costs that hit right with the birth of a child. So, all right, that's the basic idea. I think, Wells, as you alluded to, you know, the first question we always like to talk about in these discussions is, what's the actual problem we're trying to solve here? And, you know, with family policy and these kinds of programs, they're sometimes called a child credit or a child allowance. It's really interesting to see how far people diverge, even just on what they say they're trying to do. And so, you know, you have from the left, and you look at what the Biden White House had proposed on this front. They had a program that would just be an automatic credit paid to all families for children, and really pitched it as basically an anti-poverty program, that this was going to be a way to get a lot of money to the poorest families and therefore lift children out of poverty. We've been less enthusiastic about that way of framing, but actually, as we've talked about, there are a lot of ways to think about it. So, Chris, we'll start with you. What is your preferred way of talking about this kind of approach?
For me, I think I prefer to start simple, which is just is increasingly expensive to form and raise a family. That problem is getting worse rather than better for people in the working class and middle class. And if you combine that economic reality with a political point of view that families matter and that the nation has an interest in helping families form and thrive, then you get a pretty compelling case for some type of direct financial assistance to working families. And what fascinates me is the extent to which working Americans agree with that framing. I mean, we've done plenty of research at American Compass on this question. And, you know, upwards of 60% of you know, parenting age Americans say that the government should be doing more to support families. A large percentage of working families say that the reason they don't have as many kids as they want is because it's unaffordable. And, you know, Orrin, you've done a lot of really interesting research on the cost of thriving and what a family requires to thrive. And it now requires the typical earner to work more than 52 weeks in a year to earn the basket of basic necessities to have a reasonable family life. So I start there, and I think part of what makes that premise compelling is the wide and frankly bipartisan appeal and also cross-class appeal, but especially in the working class appeal of that framing. Everybody, I think, gets it at this point that this is a problem.
What I think is also worth trying to emphasize here, we're talking about family policy, the reason why you choose a cash benefit as opposed to, say, subsidizing childcare or offering paid family leave as being sort of the central plank of a conservative family policy. It's just the flexibility it gives mm-hmm. to parents, right? It actually affirms their preferences for rearing children. Mm-hmm. Not only does it acknowledge that they may want to have more or less children and helps financially support them to achieve those goals, but also enables them to have the balance of work and family life that they want to have and affirms their childcare preferences. I loved some of the polling that we did a little over a year ago that just looked at couples' childcare preferences. And the couples that said they preferred to have a full-time stay-at-home parent or part-time stay-at-home parent, which is most couples when they're raising young children, they by and large said that they preferred a cash benefit to subsidized childcare or paid leave. So this, you know, leaves paternalism to the parents, right? It allows them to choose how they're going to raise their kids and acknowledges that that's not the role of government.
Well, and it's also not the role of the professional class to dictate to the working class how they should be running and raising and forming their families.
Exactly.
And I think that's a kind of, you know, conversation we often have on this issue, that a lot of the policy proposals that come out of the institutional left in D.C., reflect the preferences of the professional class that runs the institutional left in D.C. And child care subsidies, for example, is a great example of that, where, you know, the professional class has that preference. Fair enough, they're free to do that, but that's not the preference of the working class. And everyone who bothers to ask the working class what they prefer finds that out quickly, as we did as well in our polling.
Yeah, and I think that's something that struck me even, you know, as we got deeper into the polling data, not just with, you know, your typical what kind of policies do you like questions, but really trying to understand people's attitudes and priorities on family life, is that you do have this, you know, what we call professional class, or we tend to code in our survey data as upper class, which we define as income above $150,000 a year, typically both parents who have college degrees. And that's, for one thing, not a very large segment of the population. But for another, tends to differ in very fundamental ways about just their aspirations for their lives generally. You know, in work we've done on education, they tend to be much more interested in moving further away from home in pursuit of career. And one thing that we found here on the family front is there was an interesting consistency across all groups of Americans feeling that they'd had fewer kids than they wanted to have. But when you ask them why, the lower working and middle classes all said by far the top reason was affordability. Mm-hmm. Upper class mm-hmm. said conflicts with career.
or lifestyle preferences.
That's right. Yeah, right. And so, you know, that I think maps very clearly onto this idea that, well, if you're in that group, then your idea of what you need is childcare. so that having the kids won't conflict with your career. You don't necessarily have a financial crunch first and foremost. But when you look at what everybody else is focused on and aspires to, and even how they sort of define the American dream, it's being in a position to support a family where you can have somebody staying home with kids, which means you need to have a labor market and an economy in which a single paycheck for a typical worker is going to support a family. And, you know, something that I've been struck by in the data, one way to look at it, as you mentioned, Chris, is the work we've done on what we call the Cost of Thriving Index, that just looks at, you know, what are the major costs facing mm-hmm. a family and how mm-hmm. have those risen? And they've risen to the point where a single income for a typical earner does not cover them. Mm-hmm. And obviously, families have adjusted to that by having two parents work, but that is an adjustment that in the economic data shows up as increased prosperity.
Yeah.
We have more work and income and GDP than ever before, right. And yet in people's lives can feel exactly the opposite. It can feel like a real constraint. And the thing that makes that most concrete, I think, and gives shape to to what something like the FISC can accomplish is if you look at what's happened to the distribution of income in the country, what you find is that in recent decades, a significant share of income has shifted from the middle of the distribution to the top mm-hmm. quintile. Mm-hmm. And if you just ask, well, gosh, if we'd had exactly the growth that we've had, but it had been evenly spread across the distribution, how much more income would your typical middle class family have? And the answer is $10,000 to $15,000 a year, mm-hmm. mm-hmm. which A, is exactly the gap that's forcing you into having a second parent work when you might not want to mm-hmm. make ends meet. And B is exactly what the FISC addresses. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really useful to talk in those terms about the problem that has created. Ideally, in the long run, you have an economy that's allowing a single income to provide mm-hmm. that support, but that's just not where we are today.
I mean, what you're really doing is pointing, I think, to our broader body of work on what economics has been versus what it should be and can be, and what the purposes of economic policy and the ends of economic policy really are, in this case, strong and thriving families and local communities, as opposed to a maximized GDP, the way our kind of past few decades of market fundamentalism would and have pointed us to focus on.
We're also merely trying to enable the individual to maximize their yes. preferences and utility, right? And this is why the professional class's preference for childcare subsidies and their statement of why they don't have the number of kids that they might otherwise want to have, that it's lifestyle, totally undercuts their type of argument for those policies. We recognize at least that children aren't merely a lifestyle preference. They're actually essential to having a strong, stable, thriving country and growing economy. And that's a part of why I think you can make the strong political case for having such a benefit. That this is a core interest of the country, and it's why we need to expand the social compact to offer these types of benefits and supports for families. Yeah.
And two thoughts there. One is there's an irony here, which is if the need for childcare is a feature of your family life, the FISC is perfectly flexible and it can enable you to do that should you choose. It just also allows everyone else to also, you know, choose what's right for them. And it just so happens to be the case that the preferences of the working and middle class tend to reflect different priorities. But to your point, you know, another way to answer Oren's original question of what's really in view here is also just that families matter. And you can almost put the period right there. Families matter. And if you believe that, which most Americans do across the political spectrum, as our polling has shown, well, that has certain implications for how you do economic policy. It has to.
So I want to pick up the term that Wells just used, which is social compact, which I think really goes to the core of how we think about the issue and have designed the FISC proposal. And contrasts in a lot of ways with most of the traditional proposals that are out there, because you know we've alluded to briefly what you tend to have from the left of center, and what the Biden administration did was to just say, well, there are people out there who would benefit from more money, so we are going to send everybody more money. And you know, I think there's an important kind of technocratic way in which that is not actually a good plan. Empirically speaking, just sending everybody money has not been a very wise way to address poverty. But I think it's also important to say that when you sort of ask Americans, again, across the political spectrum, is this a sensible way to fight poverty? The answer tends to be no. You know, we asked very directly, how do you feel about this as a way of addressing poverty? Would you say giving people enough money that they're no longer below the poverty threshold is actually a way to reduce poverty? And most Americans say no, that actually reducing poverty means making sure people can support themselves. And that was even true to a significant extent among Democrats, and I think has, you know, occasioned a great amount of frustration in the commentariat that just can't believe that this Biden plan wasn't more popular. Like, we don't get it. Families say they need more money. We gave everybody more money. Why isn't this the most popular thing ever? And the answer is because actually the American people are a lot smarter than that. But I think equally, you know, then when you look at what has been the traditional right-of-center view on these kinds of issues with something like the child tax credit, there's been a view that says, look, we want to give families as big a tax break mm-hmm. as we can, but they shouldn't actually be entitled to any help beyond that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, partly just as a philosophical matter, I think we should talk about how should conservatives think about that. But it runs into a really important technocratic problem, which is that those lower and working class families that are working harder than anyone mm-hmm. and are the ones really struggling to support a family, they don't have enough tax liability. If all you're doing is giving people a tax cut, you're not actually going to be able to get money, as in Wells' example earlier. If you're earning $40,000 a year as a household, we can't really give you much of a tax cut. You don't have a lot of tax liability. Right. If we want to close that gap to what, you know, in historical terms you might have been earning and get you up to $55,000 a year, it's going to have to be more than a tax credit. It's mm-hmm. going to have to be actual money coming to you. And so I don't know, Wells, if you want to talk a little bit more in just sort of how the FISC therefore conceives itself in social compact terms.
Sure. I mean, the most important, I think, dimension of it is actually the income smoothing effect and the fact that it looks back on prior year income, trying to give families as much of the flexibility as they possibly can, and understanding that families' financial needs and financial situations change, and that your income is going to fluctuate from year to year. And so you can't just depend on sort of a standard tax cut or tax deduction from year to year and really support yourself. There's also the understanding that's kind of baked into the pay-fors that we have for the FISC, which are combining some of the existing credits that exist for families that aren't super effective with also an increase on the highest earners. There's an understanding that you'll receive the FISC in your earlier earning years, your child-rearing years, and then you'll pay into it as you move up the income scale. So there's a part of this sort of intergenerational social compact that's taking place where you're borrowing money now when you can't save, you don't have the means to save or the time to save, and you're going to pay it back later in the form of taxes.
Well, and I think the most accessible analog to the, you know, most Americans is Social Security,
exactly,
which is our preeminent social insurance program, which nobody disputes. And, you know, I'm reminded of, well, nobody wise disputes. You think back to 2016, and one of the, you know, many reasons why then candidate Trump steamrolled his opponents in the Republican primary was his very loud and at the time heterodox proclamation that he would never touch Social Security and Medicare. And that is because the American public doesn't see those as handouts. They see them correctly as social insurance programs that they have paid into and then receive out from in their time of need. And what you just described, I think, is conceptually and philosophically the same, just with the sequence reversed,
right,
where because of the particular time of life that families tend to form in a young couple's life, you receive the help up front and pay it back later. But philosophically, it's the same conception, and I think that explains why when we ask people this question, it resonates so much more deeply. I mean, even one of the numbers that fascinates me is, you know, at the top of the conversation, I cited that, you know, 67% number of Americans across the board who think government should be doing more. A majority of people who describe themselves as very conservative also think the government should be doing more to support families. And if you describe that to them in a way that's philosophically and frankly morally accessible to their intuitions, it's going to land a lot different than this is an anti-poverty program, even though, let's be honest, this program will do an enormous amount to alleviate, yeah, you know, family financial distress. But you need to describe it in a way that's legible to the public. And I think that's what the left and also the right, who's still kind of caught in the straitjacket of using the tax code to do all of this, both fail to adequately appreciate and understand.
Yeah, I mean, the comparison to Social Security is absolutely spot on. You know, we understand that we need to support retirees because they're stepping out of the labor market at the same time that some of their healthcare costs mm-hmm. and life costs are going mm-hmm. to go up. It's similar for young parents, right? They aren't earning as much as they likely will later on in their careers. They're also likely having to step out of the labor market some to help raise their kids. Mm-hmm. at the same time, their costs are going up, so they're getting financially squeezed. I think the key difference is that I think the case is actually stronger for the FISC even than Social Security, because at least in Social Security, you have a lifetime of earnings that you can accumulate and even save yourself in the form of a 401k or other savings vehicles. Whereas with this, when is a young parent supposed to begin saving for their child? When they're, you know, a teenager, when they're in middle school and working an after-school job? There isn't the same kind of case for, well, this is a private responsibility you can take on.
Well, and this is a separate conversation, but I think it's adjacent to some tough conversations about the reality that economic mobility in the United States is not anywhere close to what we like to pretend that it is, and that your income bracket tends to be pretty sticky. If you were born in the bottom quintile, you're likely to stay there. And this is one of, I think, the reasons why. And I think you're pointing, again, to this broader economic critique that we make at American Compass, that things have gone wrong for working people. And something needs to be done about it. And this is, I think, appealing to so many people because it's direct and it's simple. This is a monthly cash benefit based on the number of kids you have up to a certain level of income, which is something people understand. And to the point about the tax code, and this is more on that kind of technocratic and, you know, specific administrative side of how you would do this, but it's important to note that at least in our conception, the IRS shouldn't be running a program like this. This should probably come out of the Social Security Administration.
Although they have a lot more help now with the 87,000 agents.
That's right. Well, the real reason you put them to good use. But and that's both for the philosophical reason that we just discussed, but also just because that administration is better set up to administer something like this. And I think the establishment Republican Party really has placed itself in shackles about what it can and can't conceptualize itself doing by refusing to think beyond tax liability and tinkering with the tax code.
Well, and so much of this is just the fact that the right of center is still beholden to this sort of Reaganite playbook that all policy is tax policy. We have to fiscalize literally every social policy.
And to Grover Norquist, who's going to come for you if you,
right.
if you step out of line.
Right, exactly. And as Orrin has written before, virtually all of our domestic policy is some kind of tax credit. This is true in education policy. Mm-hmm. It's true in healthcare policy. It's true now in family policy. And I think trying to move beyond that paradigm is meaningful in and of itself, beyond just the practical implications, the fact that the IRS really should not be trying to handle a benefit, especially when the SSA is already the primary administrator of child benefits in the country.
And it does require this prior argument that giving families back money they've earned in a tax refund is admirable and popular, rightly so. But this is a fundamentally different case. This is about the fact that families matter, number one. And number two, families are increasingly unable to support themselves or even to form in the first place due to economic pressures. And that's just a different theory of the case, that once you get your head around that, which and we should talk about this, that more and more on the right of center are getting their heads around it. But once you get your head around that, it opens up a whole new kind of vista of what is possible in the policy space. And the political work, so to speak, that needs to be done, I think, is helping more and more folks on the right of center, especially elected leaders, see that and then get excited about the opportunities and possibilities that opens for them to speak to this unspoken to majority of Americans who are not happy with what both the establishment Republican line is or what the Democratic line is.
Yeah. So I think that goes straight to, you know, when we think about, okay, what are the counter arguments here and what are people actually fighting about? A lot of it comes down to the point that Wells touched on, but we've glossed over to some degree, which is the way that the FISC structures a work requirement. And you have on one side from the Biden administration the view that there should simply be no work requirement and everyone should receive the benefit. And you have the traditional right of center view, which is this should be a tax credit, so it can only be a subset of the income you've earned and taxes you've paid. And what we've proposed is a middle ground, though not, I would say, really a compromise insofar as it actually infuriates people on both sides. Because the way that the FISC is structured is to say you do need to be working and earning your own income to be eligible for it. And this goes to the point about the social compact that, you know, we are basically saying you get the money up front and pay it back later, unlike Social Security. But you do need to, in real time, be showing some sort of connection to society and productive work and effort to support yourself and your family. And so, you know, we also recognize that things change. You might get laid off. The last thing we need is someone losing their benefit at the exact mm-hmm. moment they get mm-hmm. laid off. But let's look back to last year's earnings. And you need to have earned money last year, and you can't receive more from the government than you had actually earned yourself. And that just has a lot of really nice properties in how it works. Again, if you're thinking of somebody just setting out to start a family, it means they'll need to have worked the year before the child is born, mm-hmm. but actually can take mm-hmm. time out of the labor force when the child is born. It means if they lose a job, they continue the benefit and actually have plenty of time to find another job. Mm-hmm. It means there's a lot of predictability in what you're going to be receiving. You don't have to worry about tax time coming up and finding out you owe more back or you should have received more. And so it has a lot of benefits in that respect. The objections that will come from each side, and maybe I'll throw one of them at each of you. So from the left, the objection would be, well, you've just cut out the exact set of people who most need the help. Chris, tell us why that's not true.
Well, I think it's important to reflect and remember that in the proposal that American Compass put out on this, part of that conversation is a strengthened social safety net. And a proposal like this, I think, makes a lot of sense hand in hand with supporting the safety net for those who are unable to work and are genuinely in need of help. But that is a philosophically separate question from what this is, which is it's in the title of the proposal. It's an income supplement, which is another way of describing it rather than work requirement. But this is a one-to-one match for your earnings. You earn a dollar, the government will match it, which is different than, again, how the libertarian right or the progressive left talk about this. But it is something that is understandable to the majority of normal Americans who don't live and work in Washington, D.C. The safety net has a critical role. It doesn't work as well as it should. It should be strengthened. And that's something we talk about, rightly so. But it is what I would say to the left is that it is a reasonable point of view to distinguish between supporting those who are most genuinely in crisis and need and the more general point that families matter and that we do an insufficient job in the American economy of supporting families.
So that's one side. The other side now, if you bring this proposal to the right of center, there will be the just sort of abstract principle that, well, we shouldn't help people. I'm going to put that to the side because if you just don't want to help people, you don't want to help people. The I think more substantive argument that has been raised is essentially that this discourages work, and that if what you want is people to be out there with as much incentive as possible to be earning money and supporting themselves, then providing this kind of support is actually going to undercut that. So over to you, Wells. How do you respond?
Well, work is extremely important, and that's why we require it to receive a FISC. This is not a UBI, nor is it attempting to encourage parents to leave the labor force. Because it requires work, but also provides an income supplement, what it does, however, is give parents the flexibility to step back from the labor force, at least perhaps in those early years when they're receiving more of a benefit, and adjust their work hours. What it does is it allows parents, much as the way that paid leave attempts to do but doesn't do for as long of a time and is with more restrictions, is allows parents to balance the demands of child rearing and work. So I just don't buy the right of center's arguments that a child benefit like this would discourage work. It may marginally reduce the hours of, say, a new mother. I view that as a good thing. I think parents should be spending time with their children. And so I would ask those on the right of center, do they not think that workers should be spending time with their children and reducing their hours a few hours a week, especially in those early years, which a FISC would enable them to do?
And it's interesting to note, how that point of view informs the math of how this proposal is designed, it is pretty generous. And Wells, you might remember better than I do, but a working mother can work part-time at minimum wage and qualify for the full benefit for two kids, as I recall.
That's right.
So the threshold is deliberately accessible, as it should be, because we're not trying to make a judgment about what job you should have. It's a judgment that connection to the labor force is a good thing for society, but also for you. I think that's a useful point to highlight for those who are concerned with this set of questions.
Yeah, and I think the sort of part-time minimum wage job actually provides a really nice concrete litmus test for what we're talking about, because what the FISC's basic premise is to say, if you are a parent working part-time at the minimum wage, we want to get you as much support as possible. And you have a view from someone on the left that says, that's too much to ask. Actually, we should be providing the support even if someone even if that household has no one working even part-time at the minimum wage. And I think to that we would say, actually, having someone in the household working part-time at the minimum wage does seem like a reasonable expectation if you're going to be a participant in the social compact. And on the right, you have people who say, well, working part-time at the minimum wage, they should work full-time at the minimum wage, and then they should get a second job at the minimum wage, and then they should get a third job at the minimum wage.
Right.
And it's sort of somehow the actual lesson of welfare reform, which is, as you guys just said, having a connection to the workforce and doing something to be supporting yourself and also the opportunity that creates is important. Somehow that got mistranslated in the right of center brain into work is good and therefore more work is always better and our goal should be as much work as possible.
And that you as an atomized individual bear 100% of the responsibility of figuring it out regardless of what kind of work is available. And that's just not plausible, right?
And what it weirdly leads us to, sometimes you hear in arguments for, you know, a child allowance is that it should be like a parenting wage, that you essentially are compensating parents for staying at home. You're essentially trying to add a wage, right, a salary for staying at home and turning them into professional caregivers that are publicly funded. This right of center position weirdly arrives at a similar place where it says that we also should try to marketize child rearing. Parents should work full-time in the labor market, and they should then drop their kids off at essentially childcare warehouses where they're attended to by paid staff. It subjects families to the same sets of market forces that conservatives also object to in another context. So what conservatives should be arguing for is that the family is a special institution that faces all kinds of market pressures and economic forces, and insulating them from those in a common sense manner that affirms their autonomy while also respecting the institution of work and the contributions to the country is the way forward.
Yes, and even more pragmatically, I think there's a case to be made to the right of center that the kind of flexibility that an income supplement offers isn't just in the direction of staying at home if you need to. It will also make it easier to find and perform work, which is counterintuitive to the kind of libertarian mindset, but is true and is demonstrably true. And I think that's useful to point out to those who are stuck in that headspace.
Well, I think that's a pretty good summary of the policy. We would usually at this point move into naming the policy, but in this case, it is already named, and Family Income Supplemental Credit, or FISC, cannot be improved upon. Chris, if you'd like to try, this would be your chance.
Well, I think it's useful to point out that elected leaders have tried. Senator Romney and Daines and Burr have introduced the Family Security Act. I don't care for the name. I would have called it something more like the Families Matter Act. But this
Steve Urkel logo.
Yeah, exactly. You could bring him out of retirement. I haven't seen that actor in a long time.
Well, if I could just speak in favor of the Family Security Act for a moment, I think as we were just talking about the Social Security framing, the idea that this is equivalent to that for the family would be a quite strong argument in favor
that's
of the
direction. And in fairness, I hadn't considered the Steve Urkel connection, so you know I should have spent a little more time ruminating on that one.
Listeners are not surprised you're struggling here in the bill naming portion of the program.
But I think it is important just to point out to the listeners that this is not a theoretical exercise, that there are very serious legislators who have made serious proposals modeled on this approach that have garnered very widespread support from across the conservative movement and spectrum on the right of center, including, as you mentioned, from the pro-life community and many other segments of the conservative space. This is a live exercise, and I think as we look into the 118th Congress, it will continue to be a live exercise. And to the point that we keep coming back to about what the public thinks, if you want a durable political solution on this, it can't look like what the Democrats have proposed. They tried, and they couldn't get it past even their own party. That's how untenable it is. And it also can't look like what Republicans have traditionally proposed, which is just insufficient to the task and to meet the moment. I will stand by, per your argument, the Family Security Act as a pretty good title, and also as a good excuse to remind everyone that this is a real discussion out there in the legislative world.
All right. Well, on that note, I will just recommend to people at AmericanCompass.org, there is the full FISC proposal. You can read the entire white paper. You can read the one pager. All of the survey data we've been talking about is available in the Family Building Survey and a follow-up survey that we did specifically on the child tax credit. And as Chris mentioned, the Family Security Act, I believe it's Family Security Act 2.0.
That's right.
Is out there in very similar form to what we've been talking about here. And you can read about that from Senators Romney, Burr, and Daines, as well as our commentary on it that we will put in the show notes. So on that note, I think, Wells, you're welcome back anytime. Thank you very much. Chris, it's a pleasure to have you as always. And this has been Policy in Brief, the Holiday Family Special.